Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Gregory Albers, the Director of the Stanford Stroke Center and the Coyote Foundation Professor of Neurology and Neurological Sciences, as well as the founder of Rapid AI. He shared his insight into the development and the clinical use of Rapid AI in stroke care, its impact on care thus far, and what's to come for it in the future. Without further ado, let's dive in.
My name is Greg Albers. I'm the director of the Stroke Center at Stanford University and the chairman of the board and founder at Rapid AI. So this is a company that was formed out of research that we did at Stanford University, really starting in the 1990s, where we were doing some work trying to figure out what the time course of stroke is. What I'd been taught in medical school was that stroke is all over within minutes to a very few hours. In other words, it's going to be very hard to treat because by the time the patient gets into the hospital, the damage is done. There's no salvageable brain tissue left. But in the mid-90s, we developed a new imaging technique called diffusion MRI, which is a technique that allows you to actually see the stroke evolve in real time. And as we started scanning many patients with this, we could tell that what we'd learned in school was not correct, that in some patients, the stroke evolves over many, many hours, even days. And in other less fortunate patients, it does evolve very quickly so that all the damage is done, you know, within minutes to a couple of hours. So from that, we realized that this could have huge treatment implications. In other words, if there's still salvageable tissue, one shouldn't care about the time. One should be able to treat those patients. So we needed a software that would allow us to identify when the patient comes in, how much brain tissue is dead, and how much is still salvageable. So we developed this software, it's called Rapid, to accomplish that goal. And then that's was the impetus to start the company. Once we could see the software was performing well in some initial clinical trials that we did that were sponsored by the NIH, then it was clear that this needed to move outside of the academic setting into a company that could develop it, get it through the FDA, and then deploy it for commercial use.
Absolutely. And then to speak to those clinical trials, the Diffuse program, if you could just What was shown? If you could just give a little bit of insight into what exactly, you know, how the system performed in those trials and sort of what baseline expectations you had once we brought this forward out of them.
Absolutely. Yes. So the three pivotal NIH sponsored trials that were run out of Stanford were called Diffuse 1, 2, and 3. So at the beginning, the only treatment available for stroke was an IV clot-dissolving medicine called TPA. And that medicine had been shown to be, you know, quite effective if it could be given within 90 minutes and a little bit effective if it could be given up to 3 hours. So the FDA had approved this drug for a three-hour window, and it wasn't very useful overall because it's so hard to get people in, particularly in that very early time window. So what we did in the first study was that we doubled the time window. We said, let's use it at 6 hours and look to see if people who have a favorable imaging profile on this, you know, diffusion and perfusion imaging is the other thing, that the diffusion shows you what's dead, the perfusion shows you how much can be salvageable. So the idea was if you have a favorable profile, you could respond well to TPA at double the time window. That was the first study, and that's exactly what it showed, that we were giving TPA, you know, primarily at 5 to 6 hours to people, and we could see if the imaging profile looked good, they did really well. If the imaging profile looked bad, they didn't do well. So that was the first step, and it was really from that data in Diffuse 1 that the software was developed. So Diffuse 2 was the first opportunity to use the software in multiple different sites to actually see, you know, if we select patients with the software, can we have a good response to stroke treatment? So we doubled the time window again. We went out to 12 hours now, getting, you know, very aggressive to the point that many people thought, you know, these guys are crazy, right? We thought this was a something needed to be treated in 1 hour, and now they're up to 12. So in the Diffuse 2 trial, instead of using the intravenous clot dissolver, there was a new approach that was becoming exciting by that point, which was called mechanical thrombectomy. This is where you go up with a catheter up into the brain and you grab a hold of the clot and you pull it out. So we tested that in Diffuse 2, looking at patients out to 12 hours. And the preliminary findings of this study, although it wasn't randomized, it wasn't that half were getting the treatment and half weren't. Everybody was getting the treatment, but what we were assessing is, does the treatment work better if you have a favorable imaging profile than if you don't? And the answer was, again, very definitive, that all the way out to 12 hours, if you had a favorable imaging profile and you plucked out the clot with this mechanical retriever, these patients were having dramatic recoveries. So that was kind of phase two. Phase three was the definitive randomized studies. These would be randomized studies that could take patients at a very extended time window and say the only patients we're going to put in now are patients with a favorable profile. We've learned from Diffuse 1 and Diffuse 2 that people with an unfavorable imaging profile don't do well. So let's just focus on those with a favorable imaging profile, and now we will randomize them. So half of them will get the mechanical stent retriever, and the other half will not, because standard of care for late window was, no thrombectomy treatment, right? Because by this time, as we got to the Diffuse 3 and Dawn trial, which were the randomized trials, the mechanical thrombectomy had been shown to be effective up to 6 hours. And in two of the trials that led to that, the patients were selected with our software. So that was a little in-between step between Diffuse 2 and Diffuse 3. Diffuse 3 then randomized patients with a favorable profile in these very extended time windows and showed a huge treatment benefit, you know, a shockingly large treatment benefit. And one of the trials went out to 16 hours, the other went out to 24 hours. Both of them showed huge treatment benefits for these patients with the favorable rapid imaging profile. And this was really shocking. I mean, we presented this in 2018 at the International Stroke Meeting, the same day that was published in the New England Journal. And since the data was shared by the guideline committee, that same day, the American Heart Association guidelines were changed to quadruple the stroke treatment window, which, as I said, was now up to 6, and now it shifted to 24 hours. So we've now been, you know, 3 years into having a completely expanded window for treating stroke patients, but they have to be scanned to be able to identify these are the ones with salvageable tissue. And what we found in these trials is that up to about 50% of patients with a large vessel occlusion, those that cause the most devastating strokes, will have a favorable profile in that 16 to 24 hour window. So this is having an impact on a very large number of patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sounds like it, you essentially turned, you know, to try to avoid the term game changer, you essentially turned it on its head with, you know, extending the window out. And to your point, your just recent point, identifying this large group of the patients coming in with even LVO stroke who are potentially able to be treated at a later time and still have favorable outcomes. So I'm curious, what's sort of next for Rapid AI? Is there a plan to, you know, how often are we reexamining, you know, its capabilities and its use in clinical practice? And are there plans to adjust it to see if we could identify even more patients or, you know, other potential ways to treat these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So multiple questions in there, all great questions. First of all, for the second half is, you know, are there even more patients who can benefit? And the answer is undoubtedly yes. So 2018, we had this huge paradigm shift in where people realized that the old way of just going by the stopwatch and saying, okay, you're at 3 hours or you're at 6 hours, that doesn't make sense. You want to be able to treat patients as individuals and treat the patients who still have salvageable tissue. So this has led to a number of new trials that are in progress. So you can imagine that how you define a favorable profile is could be variable, right? At the early trials, we were relatively strict about saying, you know, it has to look really good, right? A lot of salvageable tissue and a relatively small amount that's irreversibly injured. And now the question is, well, maybe you don't need so much salvageable. Maybe a smaller amount will be okay. And maybe it's okay to already have a fair amount that's already dead if there's still quite a bit that's still salvageable. So we're expanding trials looking at the larger core patients to try to get more treated. And then we're also looking now at a big randomized trial going on throughout the U.S. called Timeless, where we say, well, if we could expand the window for the mechanical thrombectomy out to 24 hours, why can't we expand the window for an intravenous clot-dissolving medicine? So that study is looking at an up to 24-hour window where you can start with the intravenous clot-dissolving medicine, and if appropriate, then you can add on the mechanical thrombectomy. We're also looking at pediatric patients. So there's a whole group of patients that we're trying to fill out the corners, right? We have the clear concept that we can treat patients late. You know, why should 24 hours be a limit? We don't think so. We're starting to look beyond 24 hours. So absolutely, there's a lot of expansion of the treatment that's going on, taking advantage of what we've learned over the years with the imaging. Then your first part of the question is an incredible area of growth, is that what else is happening with related imaging? And there's a tremendous happening with AI-based imaging, right? Artificial intelligence, machine learning has just exploded over the past few years. So, you know, the original algorithms that we used didn't require AI, but now that AI is widely available, we have multiple new products that the company has developed that depend on the AI technology. So what can you do with AI? Well, one thing you could do is as soon as a scan comes in, the AI algorithms can screen it for all sorts of important findings and then alert physicians immediately, suppose a patient comes in and the scan shows a brain hemorrhage, right? In some ER settings, that scan doesn't get read right away, right? Sometimes it's a teleradiologist or it's in the stack for the radiologist to read the ER scans, but that should be at the top of the stack. So a software that identifies, is there a brain hemorrhage, and alerts the team and the readers, look at this, look at me right away. This looks important. That's been developed and is implemented and being widely used. Similarly, what about these large vessel occlusions, right? The most devastating strokes are the large vessel occlusions. And time is very important, right? You know, we talked about how time shouldn't be used to say, yes, you get a treatment, no, you don't. But once you've identified somebody who needs to be treated, the sooner you can treat them, the better, right? So if you can know immediately that there's a large vessel occlusion because the AI software has identified it, that's really helpful. And for example, Stanford's a comprehensive stroke center. We have many smaller hospitals that feed in patients. And we can tell with the application, the smartphone app, what's happening in any of the hospitals that are feeding patients in. So even if that's a hospital, again, where there may be some delay before they realize that the large vessel occlusion patient is there, the comprehensive center that works with those can get flagged on their phone with a notification that says large vessel occlusion detected in, you know, Monterey Hospital. Right. So this is a huge advantage, not only for us to know what's going on out in the hospitals that we serve, but also when it comes time to transfer a patient. Right. Suppose we get a call from a hospital that they want to transfer a patient. We can look on the app and we can see, do they have salvageable tissue? Do they have a brain hemorrhage? Do they have a large vessel occlusion? All of that information is there at your fingertips. It completely transforms what it's like to be on call for stroke when you can get this detailed information to make a quick decision. And from a cost point of view, it's, as you say, a game changer. Because the way it was most of my career, and I've been at Stanford since 1984, so a lot of years of taking care of stroke patients, you get a call from that hospital, say it's in Monterey, and they have very limited information about the patient. This is a busy ER. The ER doc is not a stroke expert. They think the patient may have a stroke, and you make a guess. Okay, it sounds like maybe it's a stroke. I'll send the helicopter and fly them in, which is at great expense. And then they arrive, and either you find that it's not a stroke or it's not a stroke that you can help. Would have been much better for that patient to stay in Monterey, right? But if it's a good case, then the helicopter can be in motion instantly. They are activated right away. We don't need a 15-minute discussion about the patient. We can see this is a perfect patient based on the imaging. Let's get the ambulance or the helicopter there. So some of these newer modules are really changing the approach to stroke care and making it much more efficient, not only for getting the right patient to the right place at the right time, but to once they get there, everything can go much more efficiently because you can notify the team. Everybody can see what's going on. Instead of working through six different systems with phone calls, text messages, log into this imaging, log into that imaging, here it's all there in the palm of your hand so you can make the best decisions.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Albers to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you might have missed since our last episode. Eisai and Biogen have announced that they have begun the process of completing a rolling BLA submission for their investigational Alzheimer's disease treatment, lecanemab. The therapy, which was previously known as BAN2401, has been submitted to the FDA under the accelerated approval pathway. In June, lecanemab was granted a breakthrough therapy designation, and Eisai noted that after all of the portions of the BLA are submitted to the FDA, and it is accepted, the PDUFA action date will be set. The application will likely be supported by data from the Phase 2b clinical trial, known as Study 201, which demonstrated a reduction in brain amyloid, accompanied by a consistent reduction of decline across several clinical and biomarker endpoints in patients with MCI due to Alzheimer or Alzheimer's disease dementia. In additional FDA submission news, Zogenix has announced that it submitted a supplemental NDA for fenfluramine, or Fintepla, to treat seizures associated with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. Currently, the therapy is FDA approved for Dravet syndrome, another rare epilepsy, and this NDA was backed by data from the Phase 3 study 1601, which met its primary endpoint with the treatment demonstrating significant improvement in monthly drop seizure frequency among a cohort of 263 patients with LGS. Long-term safety and efficacy of fenfluramine in an ongoing open-label extension trial is also included in this submission. Our final bit of news today is the FDA approval of AbbVie's atogepant, marketed as Qulipta, for the preventive treatment of episodic migraine in adult patients, making it the first oral CGRP receptor antagonist, known colloquially as the gepants, for this specific indication. It does join, however, rimegepant, marketed as a Nurtec ODT, as the second overall member of the Japan class, to receive approval. The decision was made based on data from a clinical program evaluating the efficacy, safety, and tolerability of atogepant in almost 2,000 patients with episodic migraine. Of those studies, one, the pivotal Phase 3 ADVANCE study, showed that those in the atogepant 10 mg, 30 mg, and 60 mg dose arms experienced decreases in mean monthly headache days of 3.9, 4.0, and 4.2 days, respectively, compared with a 2.5-day decline in the placebo arm. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Albers.
The use of AI sort of across the board has just as a complement to what the care, you know, you and the rest of the comprehensive team can provide. It just seems like it makes almost too much sense to use these. I'm curious, you know, obviously it seems like there's a lot of potential applications for this and a lot of downstream effects. The efficiency and help in prioritizing patients aside, the potential cost savings, I'm sure, is enough to motivate even larger hospital systems to look at something like this. How widespread is the use of rapid AI right now? And for potentially areas that aren't using it or something like it, you know, how would you go about sort of encouraging them to look into it?
Yeah. So again, a lot of great questions right there. Let me try to pick up a little bit with how you started with, is this too good to be true? And want to be really clear, because there are misperceptions about the AI. Some people get the idea it's all done by a computer and that the computer doesn't make any mistakes. And first of all, that's not true, that there is no AI product that is perfect. And this is not to replace the physician, which some physicians fear, that my job is going to be gone because this AI computer is going to make the diagnosis, determine the treatment. That clearly is not the case. What we see is that the AI can perform very well, but it can have false positives, it can have false negatives, and it doesn't have all of the information that the clinician has about the patient. You know, is this somebody who's in a nursing home where the family doesn't want to be aggressive or the patient doesn't want to be aggressive? You know, is this a patient who's got terminal cancer? I mean, all of these other factors that the physician is going to take into account when they make a diagnosis, the software doesn't have. So what we've seen in a number of the studies is you can look at how accurate is the physician by themselves on making some of these diagnoses, how accurate is the software by itself, and how accurate are the two when you put them together. When you put the physician and the software together, that's the real winner. Then the accuracy goes way up and the clinical decision-making is there, right? We don't want the computer to make a decision about how to treat our loved one. So we have to be cautious about the AI. We have to realize the limitation and realize it's the physician looking at it that is going to lead to making the right decision. And you don't believe, you know, 100% what the software sees. There can be artifacts that can fool the software. The patient can move at the moment of the scan, and that can fool the software. So physicians have to be carefully trained on how to recognize artifacts, how to understand the limitations. And then once you're there, then there's a tremendous advantage. So just wanted to make sure it was clear that we're not painting this as the panacea. This is an important step to help physicians. It is not the be all and end all.
Absolutely. Yeah. Complementary, not in place of. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then, you know, they said, well, how widespread is it? It's becoming very widespread. Rapid is at 1,800 hospitals. It's being used worldwide. New hospitals are joining on, and people are finding it to be, you know, very useful once they understand, you know, how it works. And, you know, there's multiple different modules. One of the things you have to watch out is being overwhelmed by the AI, right? If you've got six modules trying to tell you something right away, that can be a little overwhelming. So one of the things that's happening now is trying to integrate these modules to make the most sense. For example, if the brain hemorrhage module says there's a brain hemorrhage, then you don't need the information from the modules that deal with the non-hemorrhage strokes, right? So getting that to all work together and getting the most efficient message to the physician is very important. That's one of the things that we and others are working on. You also mentioned, you know, how do you convince the hospital that this is a good thing? Well, that's not a hard sell. Once people realize that, you know, this is going to improve time to treatment, it's going to improve outcomes, it's going to mean that you bring the right patient to your hospital rather than filling up your hospital. If you're a very busy tertiary referral hospital, you don't want to take every possible case. I mean, particularly now in the COVID era, beds are absolutely precious. So you want the right patient to come. And then finally, the CMS, the government, is helping out. There's something called the NTAP, which is an additional payment if you're using, for example, the large vessel occlusion software. They have, you know, put an additional payment that is available for selected patients that helps the hospital pay for that software. So the Medicare payment group, CMS, is recognizing that the AI is useful and coming up with policies that will make it even easier for the hospitals to acquire some of these AI software products.
Oh, that's obviously, yeah. I mean, that sort of sounds like it sells itself as an idea of something you should use. I'm curious, going forward, I know we sort of talked a little bit about, you know, the potential of AI to continue to help sort of improve the state of care and in general, sort of just the impact it's had on, you know, the timing of when we can treat patients. I'm curious, what do you sort of foresee or what are you looking forward to in that realm, AI's use, imaging in general and stroke over the next couple of years? Is there anything coming down the pike, whether it's, you know, what we're continuing to look into about what rapid AI's capabilities are or just the advances in imaging in general? What are you kind of looking out for?
Yeah, a couple of different things. One of them is obviously we can spread beyond the brain. A lot of these AI modules, the initial approved modules, have primarily been for brain-related emergency diseases, but they can be clearly applicable. We have a module for pulmonary embolism now, right? So a similar, clot to the brain, clot to the lung. Obviously, there's a lot of analogies there where you want a team to get together, know what's going on, get that clot out of there as quickly as possible. So expanding to pulmonary embolism, we've expanded into aneurysm, right? Being able to identify that this patient has an aneurysm that might be missed. Not every scan gets read by an expert neuroradiologist, and sometimes aneurysms are tough to find. So you have a general radiologist, and you have a software that says, hey, I think there's an aneurysm here. The radiologist can look and confirm or ask a neuroradiologist, is there an aneurysm here? So you can also use it to plan the treatment for the aneurysm. We want to put a special pipeline stent into this aneurysm, and it's a complicated anatomy. Let's use the AI to show what's the best stent for this particular aneurysm. So much potential to go to other indications. And then, as I mentioned before, what I'm really excited about is optimizing the way these modules work together. And really from the beginning, we can look from the time the patient is picked up by emergency medicine, the paramedics pick up the patient, they can put a few bits of information into the app, right, where you're already starting to alert the team that this sounds like it could be an important stroke patient, right? Or pulmonary embolism or whatever it is. Then the patient gets in and gets that initial scan. And then there's, decision-making possibilities. As I said, suppose that initial scan is immediately picked up as a brain hemorrhage. Then you're going down a brain hemorrhage path and you're alerting the team that takes care of brain hemorrhage. What if it suggests it's a large vessel occlusion that's going to need a thrombectomy? You can be immediately alerting those people who are going to take it to thrombectomy, so all of the steps can be coordinated, and then you're minimizing the outputs, right? I think we've already got physicians who can feel overwhelmed. Say you have all of the ischemic stroke modules are giving you some information. The hemorrhage stroke module is giving you, you're getting something about aneurysm. That's, you don't need all that at the beginning. You need to have the right information that's going to help you make that immediate decision. And then there's going to be more information for step two. So trying to get that all to coordinate the workflow in a most efficient way, it's a big challenge, but it will have a huge payoff in improving the efficiency of taking care of these patients.
Absolutely. Is there anything else you wanted to add or anything else you think the community should know about with rapid AI, what's coming, anything like that?
I mean, just the tremendous excitement, right? It's amazing to have all these possibilities. I try to point out that, we don't want to have unrealistic expectations about what AI can do, and that it really is important when you get an AI module to learn about, when it can help you and when it doesn't help you, so that you can understand that there is a partnership between the physician and the software, and that you don't just rely, if the software says X, that's reality. That's a really important misperception that I often see. So I'm really glad we got the opportunity to talk that one through. But yeah, that's, I think we did a nice job of covering a really exciting time in medicine.
Listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.